Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Josh Berry, Senior Analyst of Chronic Disease Prevention at ASTO. Thanks for joining our desk side briefing this afternoon. I will kick it off to our moderator, Dawn Berkowitz from TCN. Dawn?
Thanks so much, Josh, and good afternoon to everyone. As Josh mentioned, I'm Dawn Berkowitz, and I serve as the chair-elect of the Tobacco Control Network Executive Committee, and I'm also the director for the Center for Tobacco Prevention and Control within the Maryland Department of Health. On behalf of the TCN Executive Committee, I'm so happy to welcome the TCN members and partners joining us this afternoon, or I think this afternoon for pretty much everyone now. This is the third installment of our TCN desk side briefing series, in which we've been convening brief audio-only presentations to provide technical assistance without overly contributing to on-camera and visual virtual meeting fatigue. So with that in mind, I hope everyone has the opportunity just to relax and listen in on today's presentation, which is e-cigarette harm perceptions and support for tobacco-free campus policies. I know this is something that I, for one, am really interested in. Just a quick logistical overview. We will be recording this briefing so we can share it, an archive of the presentation, and that will be on the Resources tab of the TCN website, and we'll also share it through TCN News. We ask that all participants keep themselves on mute for the duration of this briefing to eliminate the possibility of any background noise, but please use the Zoom chat function for any information sharing or discussion, and also to submit questions to our speaker. We will have time for questions at the end. So with that brief introduction, I'm excited to now turn the floor over to our speaker this afternoon, who is Dr. Matthew Rosheim. Dr. Rosheim is an assistant professor at George Mason University in the Department of Global and Community Health. His research focuses on substance use and health outcomes. Dr. Rosheim has published numerous peer-reviewed manuscripts, appearing in prestigious journals such as the American Journal of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, the American Journal of Health Behavior, and the American Journal of Public Health. Today, he is going to be presenting on his article entitled "Aerosol, Vapor, or Chemicals: College Student Perceptions of Harm from Electronic Cigarettes and Support for a Tobacco-Free Campus Policy." Thanks so much, Dr. Rosheim, and I am going to turn it over to you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Can your word choice help combat an epidemic? One of the first public health guidelines to reduce the spread of the coronavirus was social distancing. Shortly thereafter, there was a major push to replace this with the phrase physical distancing in recognition of the importance and health benefits of maintaining social connections during this pandemic. So you all already recognize the importance of word choice in health communication. This is especially true for tobacco, where there is a continuously shifting landscape of emerging products coupled with powerful industry marketing that present frames to compete with public health interest groups and vie for public attention and acceptance. There are many framing devices in tobacco marketing and risk communication, ranging from glamorous or grotesque imagery to narratives about manipulation to simple words used to describe tobacco products and consumer behavior. Before the coronavirus emerged in the US, we were already dealing with an epidemic of youth tobacco use. I know this is going to shock you all, but there's a relatively new type of tobacco product that is the most prevalent form of tobacco use among youth and young adults. So what do you call these new tobacco products? Electronic cigarettes, e-cigs, electronic nicotine devices, electronic nicotine delivery systems, vapes, vaping devices, electronic vaping devices, nicotine vaping devices, and not even to mention when you start to differentiate these different types of devices like e-hookahs, vape pens, pod systems, vape pods, pod vapes, mods, pod mods, or brands like Juul, Puff Bar, Smoke Tech, or Smoc, Vaporesso, right? So the question is, what impact do these different names have on how harmful people perceive these products to be, their likelihood of using the product, and whether they support their inclusion in clean air or other tobacco control policies. So Google Trends is a useful tool in helping identify how much people Google different search terms. So if you look at Google searches using vaping-related words and compare them to the number of searches for electronic cigarette or e-cigarette-related words, you'll see that since around 2013, vape has absolutely dominated as the term of choice. So why does it matter if vape is the primary terminology for these products? For one, there was a study published last year in the American Journal of Public Health called The Relationship of the Terms Vape and E-Cigarette with Newspaper Content. And this study examined news articles published across the US and found that those articles that had vape in the headline were more likely to positively frame these products and negatively frame FDA regulation compared to articles using e-cigarette or e-cig in the headline. So in addition to that, the words we use for these products, they might influence how harmful people perceive them to be. And so not only what we call these devices, but the stuff that comes out of them that both users and non-users breathe in. So what do you call the stuff that comes out of e-cigarettes? Consistent with vapes being the pervasive terminology for these devices, their emissions are commonly referred to as vapor or vape clouds. Why does this matter? So shaping the way that people think about and describe secondhand smoke has been a tobacco industry tactic dating back to at least the 1970s. For example, tobacco industry representatives have referred to secondhand smoke as environmental tobacco smoke to make it sound more natural with weaker direct linkages to their products and thereby less harmful. Similarly, industry representatives have used the term passive smoking, which carries the connotation of indifference that might be used to downplay the annoyance often felt by non-smokers who are unable to avoid exposure. Today, some people seem to associate the commonly used word vapor with harmless water vapor. And we know that this stuff is not harmless. We know that it contains high levels of ultrafine particles and other toxins that are likely to increase the risk of cardiovascular and lung disease. And these are the conditions that account for the majority of smoking-related mortality. Recent laboratory evidence from mice also shows that e-cigarette emissions cause lung cancer and bladder hyperplasia, which is often an initial stage in the development of cancer. And so while most reasonable people today agree that smoking and secondhand smoke are bad for human health, the narrative around e-cigarette use has been much more focused on the assumptions that it's probably less harmful than smoking, including the made-up invalid statistic that e-cigarettes are 95% less harmful than cigarettes, whatever that might mean. And so how do we better communicate the harmfulness of this stuff that comes out of e-cigarettes? Well, we can start by using more accurate terminology that may differentially communicate risk associated with exposure. And so the public health community more often refers to e-cigarette emissions as an aerosol that's made up of chemicals. And previous research suggests that using the word chemicals might be associated with greater perceived harm. So what we did is we conducted a study at George Mason University where we sought to examine whether terminology used to describe the secondhand output of e-cigarettes influenced undergraduate students' perceptions of its harmfulness. And we also tested in this study whether perceived harmfulness of secondhand exposure to e-cigarettes was associated with support for prohibiting e-cigarette use on campus. So we studied this using a randomized experiment where we randomized what questions we asked different classrooms of college students. The purpose of randomizing classrooms is that there's something special about randomization. If you randomize a large enough group of people to different study conditions, then statistically, these different groups that you're comparing should be comparable on all characteristics. So that's what we did. We invited instructors of 167 junior level English class sections to participate in our study, and nearly one third agreed to participate. So we randomized these classrooms to one of three conditions: vapor, aerosol, or chemicals. So 17 or 18 classrooms each received questions about what they know or believe about the health effects of secondhand e-cigarette aerosol or chemicals or vapor. So there were 889 students that were present when we distributed these classroom surveys in 2018 and 2019. And of those, 94% participated. And of those that participated, 94% provided complete data for our analyses. So we had a final sample of nearly 800 students in our study. And everyone got nearly the same survey, but some classroom sections were asked about how harmful they thought secondhand exposure to e-cigarette vapor is to a person's health. And other classrooms were asked about chemicals or aerosol instead of vapor. So we just replaced the word in the question that we asked. In our analyses, we also adjusted for potentially confounding variables, including smoking or e-cigarette use behavior, as well as how harmful they perceived secondhand exposure to cigarette smoke to be. And we also asked students questions about whether they would prefer George Mason University be a smoke-free campus, yes or no, and whether they prefer that George Mason University be a 100% tobacco-free campus, including e-cigarettes, and again, answered yes or no. So our randomization process worked. All of the three groups were very similar with regard to their demographic characteristics, their previous use of tobacco products, and how harmful they perceived exposure to secondhand smoke to be. Our main study findings, one of our main study findings was that compared to the vapor condition, chemicals and aerosol conditions were associated with twice the odds of perceiving secondhand exposure to e-cigarettes to be harmful or very harmful. So just by asking students about the harmfulness of aerosol or chemicals rather than vapor, students were twice as likely to say that it was harmful or very harmful rather than slightly harmful or not at all harmful. And again, these analyses adjusted for a number of potentially confounding variables, including demographic characteristics, e-cigarette use, and students' perceptions of how harmful exposure to secondhand smoke is, which were all significantly associated with perceptions of harmfulness to exposure to e-cigarettes. So that was one of our main study findings. Our other main study finding was that students who perceived secondhand exposure to e-cigarettes to be more harmful were then more likely to support a 100% tobacco-free campus policy that included e-cigarettes, even after adjusting for their use of e-cigarettes and their support for a tobacco or a smoke-free campus policy. So greater perceived harm from secondhand e-cigarette exposure was associated with increased odds of supporting a 100% tobacco-free campus policy. In conclusion, our study highlights the importance of using accurate terminology like aerosol or chemicals to describe e-cigarette emissions. Tobacco policy advocates and communication campaign developers should recognize the power of framing and avoid using inaccurate terms that perpetuate misconceptions of minimal harm from e-cigarette use and exposure. So, can your word choice help combat an epidemic? I think so. I think that this is a battle that we have control over and we can win. We can all choose what words we use to describe these products and their emissions. And those choices impact how harmful people perceive these products to be, which influences their support for tobacco control policies. So despite the tobacco industry's attempts to call it passive smoking or ETS, environmental tobacco smoke, today people call it secondhand smoke. So let's use more accurate terminology and let's talk less about the vapor from vapes and more about the chemicals from e-cigarettes. So, because of the rigorous methods that we used in this study, the experimental study design, this study has what we call strong internal validity. That means that we are very scientifically confident in our study findings. What we're less certain about is the extent to which these study findings actually apply to other populations, because this study only included students at one university. And so we're planning to launch a follow-up study in just a few days now. We'll start data collection. And it's going to include a more general sample of people across the United States. And this study is going to examine some important new research questions as well. I'd love to hear from you all, your feedback, whether there are additional important research questions or wordings that we might have overlooked. But essentially, what we're planning to do is we're planning to ask about how harmful and how addictive people perceive e-cigarette use or vaping to be. So we're randomizing participants first to conditions based on what we call the device. In the previous study, we just called it e-cigarettes. And in this study, we're randomizing based on the device and its use, so e-cigarette use versus vaping. Then within those groups, we're gonna randomize people again within the e-cigarette use and the vaping conditions to different study conditions, testing wording again for the emissions of the devices. So aerosol, chemicals, and vapor like before, and then also adding the more general term emissions as well. So we'll essentially be examining the combination of different words for the device and its emissions and people's perceptions of harm from secondhand exposure. And there's essentially gonna be 8 different groups here, the vapor, aerosol, chemical, and emissions groups matched with either e-cigarettes or vapes. In addition, it's common for people to use marijuana in these products. So we're also going to be examining how harmful and addictive people perceive this to be while testing different wording for this. So we're gonna test cannabis, marijuana, THC oil, and hash oil. So again, people will be randomized to one of 8 different conditions here. They'll be in the same 2 groups for the label of the device that they were in before, and then we'll randomize these 4 words for cannabis. So people will get asked questions like, some people will get asked, how harmful do you think using cannabis in an e-cigarette is to a person's health? And other people will be asked how harmful they think using marijuana in a vape is to a person's health, and so forth. So in addition to this one new study, I'm also currently collaborating with Dr. Xiaotran Xiao in the communication department at George Mason University and mentoring a large number of undergraduate and graduate students as they develop and test e-cigarette counter-marketing messages among young adults. I expect that we will have numerous publications forthcoming in the next couple of years related to these projects that should be useful in further guiding e-cigarette counter-marketing messages, their development and selection of these messages. And I think that these studies really have some interesting research questions and designs. Some of these include designing and testing some graphic warning labels for e-cigarettes. Some of them test whether the color of the message and images might impact their effectiveness. Another series of tests looks at the impact of depicting e-cigarette use itself in these counter-marketing messages might have versus not depicting use. Another study looks at how positive or negative comments on social media platforms might impact the effectiveness of video counter-marketing messages. So we're currently collecting data for all of these projects through a variety of different platforms, through classrooms, through Amazon MTurk, through social media. And I'm really excited to see the results of all these studies and hopefully be able to share with you the results of these studies as well, as they may continue to help inform the development and selection of effective counter-marketing messages. So I want to thank you all for the opportunity to share some of my research with you, and I'm really excited to hear what questions or suggestions you all might have.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rosheim. I think this is really interesting and relevant research, as you mentioned, not only for policy efforts, but also for counter-marketing. I think, you know, a lot of state health department folks on the line, like myself, have really looked at a lot of this for our own counter-marketing efforts and prevention efforts. And, you know, you don't want the unintended consequences of things looking less harmful when you're working on prevention messaging. So I think this is really interesting, and we'll definitely look forward to your follow-up study and projects. So I really appreciate your time and your work on this. We have set aside the rest of the time for Q&A. And as I mentioned, you can use the chat function if you have questions for Dr. Rosheim. Please enter those now. And for now, I'm going to turn things back over to Josh Berry, who's the Senior Analyst of Chronic Disease Prevention at ASTO, as well as Leanna Broges, who's the Analyst of Chronic Disease Prevention at ASTO, to moderate this discussion. Josh and Leanna, it's yours.
Thanks so much, Dawn, and thanks again, Dr. Rosheim, for being with us. So I'll echo what Dawn shared about being able to use the chat box during the duration of our Q&A time this afternoon. And to get us started with the questions, I will turn things over to my colleague, Leanna.
Thank you, Josh, and thank you, Dr. Rosheim, for that wonderful presentation. I'll start with the first question. Given the strong link between tobacco use and COVID-19 transmission, how can we encourage schools to implement smoke-free campus policies?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's something that I'm currently working with right now. I'm the project lead on an American Cancer Society grant designed to help support Mason as we look to, George Mason University, as we look towards implementing a 100% tobacco-free campus policy. I think the one way that it is really helpful is in getting the attention of the senior leadership of the university. Everyone has in university settings right now, massive financial issues at hand, along with protecting the public health and safety of students and employees on campus. So I think that by explaining to university administrators, who oftentimes, at least at our university, we're not at all aware of the link between e-cigarette use among young people and smoking and the spread of the coronavirus, that helps set this as an important issue on the agenda for them. And so if they are already having safety issues in mind as they're reopening campus and are instituting policies that they never have before, like wearing masks and physical distancing, these types of policies, these tobacco-free campus policies, are always a common sense public health measure, and especially so at this time. So my hope is that this actually facilitates moving forward with these types of policies that are really important for protecting the health and safety of everyone on campus and making a more inclusive working and learning environment for everyone. Great question.
Great. Well, I see that we have a chat box question. So Josh, I can turn it back over to you so we can get that answered. Thank you so much, Dr. Rosheim.
Yes, absolutely. So we have a chat box question from Ann Staples talking about how they've had the issue that their YRBS, their Youth Risk Tobacco Survey, asks high school, middle school students if they use vaping products, while their Youth Tobacco Survey asks about whether they use e-cigarettes. And the answers are always much higher when they ask about vaping products. So Dr. Rosheim, do you have any thoughts about why this is the case and whether there's a way to be more clear about what we're asking our adolescents in surveys?
It's a great question. So I think this is a couple of issues here. I think one is just in how do we collect accurate surveillance data so that we're actually understand the effectiveness of our programs and the burden of the issue right now, or the magnitude of the epidemic. I think with regard to that, some of the best practices are clearly defining at the beginning of the survey what all is included in these, our definition of what we're calling e-cigarettes and what we're calling vaping products, and I think this is something that everyone struggles with because this landscape continues to evolve. I think one thing that is very helpful is, if possible, to include images of all of the different types of products so that people can visually recognize what all that we're talking about. However, again, this, you know, it might need to be updated as new products emerge and take over the US market. So I think that's one way for, just from a surveillance perspective, making sure that they're clearly defined and inclusive before asking just a simple, you know, have you used a vaping product in the last 30 days or in your lifetime? From a communication perspective, I think it's even more tricky, you know, with which words that we use, figuring out what language young people, you know, resonates that they use. We want the messaging to resonate with them, so we want to use the same type of language that they do, while we simultaneously want to convey the harms. For example, we're just conducting studies for those 18 and older right now, but would younger people even recognize some of these terminology, like what cannabis means or things like that? Yeah, that we absolutely need more research with regard to younger populations, which are oftentimes harder for us researchers to access and have more red tape. So great question.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Dr. Rosheim. And for our final question, I will turn things back over to Liana.
All right, for the last question, Dr. Rosheim, what messaging do you think is most effective at communicating the need for accurate e-cigarette emission labeling?
Could you repeat that question one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. What messaging do you think is most effective at communicating the need for that accurate e-cigarette emission labeling?
So who is the target audience for this? Is this people who are making the policies, or who is this messaging for, the general public?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that I'm entirely understanding the question, because you said the need for what was it?
Communicating the need for that accurate e-cigarette emission labeling. So instead of just vapor chemicals. So I guess who or what would be most effective at communicating the need for that language change?
Gotcha. You know, I think that this is a good start here, sharing with people who are working in the tobacco prevention and control field, who are responsible for developing or selecting counter-marketing messages. I think having conversations with you all, and you all might be experts in this regard as well, and might be able to help inform me where we need to bring this research and what messaging is needed so that it gets more widely adopted as well. That's a great question, and I'm not sure that I have a great answer for that at this time.
No, that was a wonderful answer. And I'm glad that we can, you know, be a part of helping to contribute to that. So with that being said, thank you so much for answering those questions, Dr. Rosheim. At this time, I will turn it back to you, Dawn, to conclude us for the afternoon.
Thanks so much, Liana, and to you, Josh. And thanks again, Dr. Rosheim, for joining us this afternoon to provide us with this summary of your research on e-cigarette emission phrasing and its perception among college students. I think, as you said, you know, we will continue this conversation, and we'll look forward to your additional research. And just a quick reminder to everyone before we adjourn, we always like to encourage our members to visit the TCN website at tobaccocontrolnetwork.org to access the numerous resources there, which includes a member directory, an interactive tobacco policy map, archives of all the TCN newsletters and past TCN resources, along with several other features. So with that, I'm going to get ready to conclude today's desk-side briefing. Thanks again to Dr. Rosheim and to our colleagues at ASTO for making this briefing possible. And also thank you to CDC OSH Program Services Branch for supporting all of our work. Please keep an eye out for future TCN virtual desk-side briefings that provide insights to help the TCN membership address the many new and familiar challenges that are facing all of us in state and territorial tobacco control. If you have any questions or any recommendations for future topics, please let us know. Don't hesitate to reach out to us. The best way is at tcn@asto.org. Again, that's tcn@asto.org. Send us an email. And thank you for joining us and enjoy the rest of your day. And with that, we will conclude. Thanks, everyone.